Hey, this is the Middle Coast. You're hearing from
Roman,
Dylan,
and Liam,
and you're listening to Endeavors Radio.
No, it's never that easy, he says as he walks away. Shotgun and marriage was not what he wanted. It's never that easy, she says as she walks away. A rich man and money was not what she wanted. Her lover don't know it yet, thinks it's all in his head. She stay out late and she don't call.
Endeavors. That was the song Paycheck by The Middle Coast off their album The Making Of. You'll be hearing from Middle Coast later on in the show. We also have Dave Schultz, who is the writer-director of a new film called Considering Love and Other Magic. And I'm dubbing this show the Winnipeg Special, as The Middle Coast is from Winnipeg. Originally Brantford, now they're in the big city, and Considering Love takes place in that city. So it's a feature city on this week's show. Apologies for only having the one show this week. I was very busy being on set on Tuesday, slowly getting back into the acting thing here in Toronto, and I didn't have a voice on Wednesday, so I just decided to take it easy and do one show this week. But the good news is we have a lot of good stuff coming up. I got the Whistler Film Festival, and later this week I've got 5440, AJ Jacobs coming up later in the month. We've got Greg Sestero, so it's gonna be a really great few weeks here on the show. As I mentioned, our opening guest today is Dave Schultz, and Dave Schultz is a writer-director who is based in Calgary, And he has a new film called Considering Love and Other Magic. But Dave has done a lot more. One of my favorite films was his first film as writer-director, and it's the great cult classic Jet Boy with Kelly Rowan and Dylan Walsh. He's also written and directed three others, including RPM, 45 RPM Rufus, and of course the new Considering Love and Other Magic. He's also written a lot of action films that he hasn't directed, including the upcoming The Humanity Bureau, starring a guy you may have heard of, Nicolas Cage. And that comes out in April, I believe. He's also written films such as One of Our Own, starring Michael Ironside, Silent Cradle with Margot Kidder and Lorraine Bracco. He had a film called Question of Privilege, and as well as Double Frame with Daniel Baldwin, James Remar, and Leslie Hope, and of course Anthrax with Ed Begley Jr. But Considering Love and Other Magic is considerably lighter fare. It's a family film, but it has a bit of a dark edge to it. And the film has got great actors, Sheila McCarthy and Eric McCormack. So Dave Schultz is the writer-director, and I spoke with him earlier this week about the film. Dave Schultz, hello, welcome to the show.
Yes, hello, Dan, nice to meet you.
Considering Love and Other Magic, I know in your previous work, at least in the ones you've both written and directed, there's always, you know, some concept of family. Where did the idea of this fantasy come from for you?
You know, I don't really know. I started writing it after I did my last feature, kind of a semi-vampire movie called Rufus, which had a lot of fantasy in it. And I don't know, it just popped in my head. I must have been kicking around for a while. And yeah, I guess it's just the family aspect. Most of my movies tend to be about myself, so I guess it came from me as a kid. So I don't know if that helps. But yeah, I think that, you know, I think relationships and friendships are very important to all of us, and I kind of think, I guess that's where the magic comes from in Considering and Love and Other Magic, which is a very long title. You know, they wanted me to chop it down because, you know, it's tough to squeeze that onto a one-sheet poster. But I thought the magic part was important. So, yeah, the magic is friendship. And I guess I just think most of our lives are about the people we know. And the situations we go through in life, I think, have a lot to do with other people we interact with.
I see a few similarities with some of your other work. I'm familiar with the film Jet Boy.
Jet Boy, my cult classic. Yes.
Which I know was your debut as a director. But some of the similarities I know is that you sort of have like this with Considering Love. You have like this sort of lighter story, but there's an element of darkness underneath. Why do you like sort of finding the dark amongst the light and the light amongst the dark?
I think that, you know, I think that when you're dealing with some dark subjects, I think a way to lighten it up is to use a bit of humor. I think that although, you know, dark issues in our lives, you know, take up a lot of space, it's because they are dark. But I think the world is basically better. You know, I think the world is friendlier than we think. And I think with Jet Boy, which, you know, I mean, I did that a very long time ago, and it's amazing how much, I mean, that film, like I said, is like a classic in Europe now. But I think that, you know, as a kid, I always wanted, you know, the White Knight to come along and save me. And I think that with Considering in Love, I think that theme is, I kind of like the idea of people in danger being saved by someone who cares about them. And I think that no matter how tough your life is or how tough the circumstance is, if you have someone that cares about you, that's the first step. And I guess that's the simplicity of all of them. So they're all kind of based around, I don't know if I keep trying to refine the same idea. I'm doing a sci-fi that I want to do a co-pro with Ireland with called The Garden. It's a sci-fi, but it has similar themes. I think those type of, I think when I write that kind of story that I want to tell, I want people to you know, to see that there is hope out there. And no matter how tough your situation is, if you meet the right people, maybe things just might turn out. So I guess that's the, you know, similarity between Considering Love and Jet Boy, which of course are two completely different movies. Yet if you dig down deep, the core theme is pretty much the same. But I think Rufus, my vampire movie, is kind of the same feel as well.
Well, with all four of your films, you know, this one and Jet Boy, Rufus, and 45 RPM, all your protagonists are young people in their teens.
Yeah.
Why that age for you? What is it about that period of life that you always find yourself coming back to?
Well, I think there's twofold. I think personally, I think that was a very interesting time for my own life. And I think that as teens, well, all of us obviously were teens at one time, I think we're dealing with a lot of issues at that age, a lot of issues that we're not always prepared to deal with. I also think what's really cool with working with young people, first as actors, they're always fun to work with. But I think that if you take a grown-up and you put them in a certain situation, they tend to act a certain way. And I'm talking story-wise. And yet with a young person, because they haven't had the same experiences in life, you can take the story somewhere, anywhere it may not lead. You know, I mean, having and Considering Love, you have this, you know, boy who refuses to leave the house, and he tells this girl that, you know, he's imaginary because his aunt's a writer, so he believes himself to be an imaginary character, you know, from a novel, that and he can't leave the house. Well, that's a believable story for coming from a young person who's trying to deal with issues. It'd be a completely different story if it was a grown-up dealing with that issue, right? And it'd be a little more, you know, a little more, you know, mental illness side to it if it was, you know, say a 40-year-old or something. But with a kid, you can kind of get away with that. So I think that you can deal with darker subjects or maybe a little more touchier subjects by dealing with them with, you know, younger people, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. And yet, this is the first time where you've made the actual lead character a female. I know in the other three, you know, the teenage boys were the centerpiece. How does that change your perspective at all, do you think?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I just finished doing a movie with Nicolas Cage where he's the lead. You know, it's a dystopian movie. So it's gone from the, you know, the female teenage girl to, you know, to a man in his 50s playing the lead. But I think, you know, well, character and characterization, I mean, really, it's the same. It's the same person. I just thought this story would be told better through a female. You know, most of my movies have a lot of empathy too. So even Jet Boy and Rufus and 45 RPM, they tend to skew more female than male when you look at the demographics for the audience. So it just felt right that this was a story about a girl who had lost her brother and didn't know how to deal with it. And the movie wasn't going to be about, you know, how her brother died or why. It was more going to be about how she was going to deal with it. And it felt like it should be told through a female perspective. And so, but you know, I think it, you know, I think she's similar to a lot of the other characters I deal with.
Is it easier to write for the same gender character or someone who's different than you?
Well, you know, I mean, these are the films I've written and directed myself. I started out doing a lot of suspense thrillers for like Showtime and the Lifetime Network. So I've done, you know, like a lot of female leads. I've written a lot of female lead characters. And I think when you're writing, I mean, I think the gender is really not that important. I think what's more important is, you know, the type of person you're trying to convey, who they are on the inside. So I find them both challenging and both equally rewarding. You know, it just depends who the story is better told through. You know, like I said, on the latest movie, The Humanity Bureau, that comes out in February, it's a dystopian picture with Nicolas Cage playing the lead. And he's kind of a guy who's ends up being the surrogate father to this woman and her boy, and kind of turns into this family trying to find their way, you know, out of the wilderness. And so, but the themes are the same. So you go, it's still about people trying to find a better path or a better way.
You know, you had read a lot of films and a lot of action films before you got to direct one of your own.
Yeah.
What was the experience of directing your own words versus having somebody else direct them for you? How different is that for you?
Well, I think the thing is, when you're writing, I mean, you see the movie in its most perfect form. I mean, you know, you see every possibility in every location. I mean, obviously, when you're directing a movie, there's certain limitations, you know. I mean, what I think is fascinating is that, you know, writing is kind of like a daydream, really. And then, of course, all of a sudden, they go from being fictional people to real actors that are real human beings that live and breathe, right? And so there's always interpretation. I think in a way, it's easier just to write, because you don't have to worry about all those demands. You don't have to go on set and deal with, you know, the 25-day movie you're trying to shoot in 20 days or 18, or that kind of a thing. It's always a balancing act between your ultimate vision and what you're able to do. I mean, obviously, you know, you're not going to have a fleet of helicopters coming over, flying over the horizon on a Canadian film, you know, when you're dealing with a budget of $2 or $3 million, right? So they're both very different challenges. Mind you, when you're just writing, it really helps to have a good director and a good producer, you know, or someone who's taking your vision and trying to add something to it. So they're both very different breeds. But people have asked me that before: is it hard when you just write and then someone else directs? No, it's just different. You know, the priorities are different, and you're still writing, you know, the best thing you can write. It's just movies. They take a lot of money, and they take a lot of time, and they take a lot of people to make. You're not doing a play. You know, a play, you get a chance to do it different. You know, if you screw up one night, you can try to make it better the next. In a movie, what you shoot, that's it. That's there. That's there forever, right?
Yeah. Let's talk about casting, because the film has a couple of great actors. For how early on did you decide that you wanted Eric McCormack to play this sort of dapper 50s English gent?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think when I mostly cast, when I mostly write a movie, I don't really picture actors up front. I picture more character types. So when I write any film, I don't really picture, oh, it's going to be played by Eric McCormack, or it's going to be Nicolas Cage, or it's going to be Michael Madsen, that kind of thing. I think that kind of happens more kind of in the production process. I think with Eric, I knew that I wanted kind of this, you know, this dime store detective from the 1940s kind of a feel. And what's very interesting, you know, when he came along, I actually told him that he had to be in character the whole time. So the whole time Eric was on set in Winnipeg, he always spoke in a British accent. So I didn't really quite, you know, I hadn't heard his real voice in a long time, because, you know, so it was very interesting to watch, you know, old episodes of television, or watch him in The Travelers, which is on Netflix right now. And go, oh my God, he speaks like in a North American accent. So yeah, he kept in character the whole time, if you can believe it. Like, the whole time that I worked with Eric, he was Jasper Timon, detective.
Why did you feel that was a decision that you wanted to have him do, to have him remain in character the whole time, rather than just when the cameras are rolling?
I think it was more for me. I think because I wasn't sure. You know, it's very tricky when you take an actor who isn't really of that, you know, who isn't really English and doesn't really have an English accent. And so I had to believe him in the role. So it was a big debate whether, you know, there were people, I mean, who were involved in the production, you know, oh, you should just have him talk in his regular voice, or you shouldn't have the mustache or whatever. Oh, it's always risky doing if he's going to do an accent. And I thought, well, if he shows up in character and I believe him as Jasper Diamond, then I'll know it's true. So I guess it was really a test when he first showed up. That is he going to be believable as this character? He's such a great actor. I mean, yeah, he's very good. And so then he just kept it up. And I said he had to stay in character, and he stayed in character. And I thought, well, that's cool. And so I always kind of talked to him as if he was Jasper Diamond, and it seemed to work for us. You know, it's a little strange, but yeah, so that's quite interesting in a way. Yeah, I guess it was more for me. I just needed to believe that he was Jasper Diamond. And then it's the first time I've done that, actually, but it was... worked out just fine. I mean, he's such a bigger than life character in the movie, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's an odd way to go, and he did an excellent job, you know. So, yeah,
and then,
that's why. No, I guess it was more for me than him.
Yeah, and then you've got Sheila McCarthy, which as the sort of neurotic author, which I think is a brilliant piece of casting.
Yeah, she's a great lady.
How did she come aboard? Was she someone you had in mind from early on as well?
No. I mean, I obviously do her career. I mean, I go back. I'm old enough to remember her in her first movie. It was since I heard the Mermaids sing. I remember her career when she was, you know, in her early 20s. I don't know. She just came along, and she was suggested. Like I said, I don't really pre-think who's going to be in the movie. And she came, and she just seemed so perfect for it. And, you know, she was supposed to be much older. I mean, really, in the movie, she's supposed to be like Tommy's grandmother. So, I mean, she'd be really, really old, right? And, I mean, really, in real life, she's my age. But the film kind of plays between, you know, reality and imagination, so it works just fine. And she was just really easy to work with. Super easy. I mean, you don't really have to direct her much. You know, she just fit into it so well. Just looking at the poster right now as we're talking, and... yeah, you know, she has that kind of, you know, she's the anchor for this boy who doesn't know what world he lives in. And it's very interesting because in the movie, there's this thing, you know, is Jasper kind of real? Is he a ghost in the house, or is he just in Tommy's imagination? And I think throughout the movie, you kind of wonder, can Veronica, like Veronica talks about Jasper as if he's real because she's a writer. And of course, you know, as a writer, characters are always kind of real in your head. But there's always a bit of a debate in the movie when you watch it, if she believes that, you know, Jasper is real or if he's just a fictional character. So it's kind of a neat little play. She does a good balancing act on that.
I'm curious as to whether you were trying to say anything about writers and the creative process with the story and with the character of Veronica.
Maybe, huh? I mean, you know, this movie, we shot this like almost 2 years ago now, and it's just coming out in Canada now, but it's already, you know, I mean, it's already overseas, been released in Asia and in Latin America, that kind of a thing. So I was actually saying to my girlfriend today, because, you know, we're doing the publicity push, obviously, now in the film, that I think I understand the movie better now than I did when I made it. And, yeah, I guess subliminally, I never really thought about it. Yeah, I'm a writer, and so I wrote a movie about a writer, and, you know, and it just, I don't know, it just, I don't know where it came from, it just popped out, and it's, you know, I kind of like this idea of, you know, the fantasy mind, but I do know, you know, when I wrote her character, I do know that the characters I write, they feel very real to me, so I thought she would probably think that way as well, but she did an excellent job. I mean, the poor thing had to work with that old typewriter, my God, you know, I mean, that was a... You know, the hardest part was the, you know, the 50-year-old typewriter we used, which, you know, they're not easy to find anymore, you know. It's harder to find some of these props than you would think that are in actually working order, you know. I actually remember writing my first script on a typewriter, but, you know, finding one that actually functions properly these days is not an easy thing.
And I know you shot the film in Winnipeg, your hometown. Shooting a film in an environment like that, and also an environment that's very familiar to you, did that make the process easier or more difficult?
I think there were two things. You know, I was born in Winnipeg, but I haven't shot in there. I haven't shot with that crew before. We actually shot in a high school that my father went to in the 1950s. My father passed away years ago, but we actually shot in the high school where he went, which was kind of cool. Right? You know, like you're shooting a movie. You know, your parents never want you to go into the arts, of course, right? Because they think that you're going to starve to death. And I remember my father saying, don't ever become a filmmaker. You know, you're never going to make any money. And then here we are, you know, shooting a movie in the very school that he went to high school in. So that was neat. I think what's, you know, if anyone's listening who is in the film business or wants to make film, I think it's tough when you go to a different community. I had a great time in Winnipeg, but you're dealing with a different crew, right? I mean, it's kind of like going to someone else's summer camp, if you know what I mean. Like, you know, you're using a new director of photography, and you're working with crew people who are very competent, but people you don't necessarily know. And so there's a bit of a learning curve there. Like, you're all showing up, and, you know, they all have their lunches with their names on their little Tupperware containers because, you know, the caterer knows them all by name and you don't. And so it's kind of interesting. That's kind of how it felt. It felt like I was at someone else's summer camp and you have to kind of, you know, learn the ropes really quickly because they have different way of doing things. And some of the rules are a little bit different in shooting in Winnipeg than they are shooting in Saskatchewan or Calgary. So that was interesting. But they have tons of big old houses there. And, you know, it's an older city, right, compared to Calgary. So, and we were trying to do, you know, a modern movie that kind of had this period element to it. So, I think, you know, the big old mansion we used and stuff, I think that would have been more difficult to find in Calgary than in Winnipeg. So,
Where do you think Manitoba and Winnipeg, what role do you think they play in shaping the cultural identity of Canada? You know, for music, they've got Neil Young and Randy Bachman. For film, they've got Guy Madden. Where do you think Winnipeg falls in our sort of creative identity?
Well, that's a tough one, you know. I mean, you have to remember, I mean, I grew up in Winnipeg as a child, so I have a very nostalgic kind of view towards what Winnipeg is. And then I go and make a movie that has a very nostalgic feel to it as well. So I may be a little bit biased, but, you know, it's interesting because it's the prairies, but it's kind of stuck between Ontario and Alberta and British Columbia, which are very different. You know, it's a, I don't know when last time you were in Winnipeg, but it's a very different, it's kind of more locked in time. You know, it feels like when you're in Manitoba, you kind of feels like the 1980s and the 1970s. They have so many old buildings, right? But like all the ones that are in Calgary have been torn down, where Winnipeg still has this rich history of these really old classic buildings from the day that, you know, back in the day when it was, you know, a big industrial center back in the 20s and stuff. So I don't know. It's a hard question to answer, but all I can really say is I really enjoyed shooting there and the people were good. And but it definitely has its own landscape. I mean, and yes, Randy Bachman and Burton Cummings are still huge names there. I think Burton Cummings' name is on almost every second building in downtown. So that's most interesting.
You mentioned briefly the Humanity Bureau, but I know that that's your next film that you wrote, and that's with that's coming out in February with Nicolas Cage.
February, yeah.
What can you tell us about that? What are you looking forward to when that comes out?
Well, I've already seen it because, you know, I wrote it, so I get to see it before other people. I don't know. I think that it was. Someone asked me before, you know, gee, that seems so different than what you're, you know, than the, than considering Love of the Magic, but not really. I mean, you watch these movies, you're going to watch all my films, including the Humanity Bureau, which Rob King directed, by the way. He's out of Toronto, an excellent director. I'd like to give him a plug. And Kevin DeWalt produced the Humanity Bureau. He was exceptionally good to work with. I think they all have to do with they all have to do with humanity. They all have to do with relationships between people. And so even though one, the dystopian movie with a lot of machine gun fire in it, if you dig down to the very basics, they're very similar to all my other films. So I'm just hoping it does well. I mean, it's got Nicolas Cage in it, so it's already pre-sold to, like, I think they went to Berlin last year and sold to like 40, 50 countries overnight. So, you know, I mean, there's a big draw there with that name. And, so I just hope people enjoy it. I've got a sci-fi of my own that I'm trying to finance. I want to do as a co-production with Ireland, a tree co-production called The Garden, which is kind of a parallel universe kind of thing, which has a little bit to do with, I guess, considering love, because they deal with fantasy worlds, you know, what world is real and which one is fictional. And that's the project I'm working on now. And it's different, you know, when you write and direct and you know, basically raise your own money and produce your own stuff with other people, there's a lot of business. It's not just writing, there's a lot of business involved. It's not easy making a movie, you know, pretty not, you know. So,
well, the film is considering love and other magic. Dave Schultz, writer-director, thanks so much for your time today.
Yeah, you know, if I could just say, if people want to see more, if you go to consideringlovethemovie.com, you can see the trailer and see showtimes and stuff. And I think in Toronto it's playing, it starts next Friday.
Yes, I believe you're correct.
Yeah, next Friday at the Carlton Cinema. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyways, it was great, and good luck with all your stuff. And I really appreciate you taking the time to talk about my movie. It's pretty cool stuff. Thank you.
No worries, Dave. Thank you. Take care. Mm-hmm. All right. Ciao.
Do you have everything you need?
And once again, that was Dave Schultz, the writer-director of the film Considering Love and Other Magic. This is The Middle Coast with Every Now and Then.
One, two, three.
Why did it end? I don't remember, but we could pretend to make it better. Yeah, let's try this again. Although we know that it never ends well. It never ends well. Fight again.
Every now and then I think of calling you up. Deep down I really know I shouldn't smoke, just like I know I shouldn't call you up. As much as we know this isn't working well, I can't let you go. It isn't perfect, but you must understand I still feel something.
That was Every Now and Then by The Middle Coast off their new album, The Making of. The Middle Coast is Liam Duncan, Dylan McDonald, and Roman Clark. And although they now reside in Winnipeg, they come from the town of Brandon, Manitoba. In addition to their music, they are also on the search for the perfect fast food burger and some of the great places to eat in Winnipeg. Their new album is The Making of, and it came out in April. And they would describe themselves as a 70s-style yacht rock that will be the new soundtrack to your dockside daydreams and breezy evening vibes. And their influences range from the Guess Who to the Eagles to Hall & Oates, with tinges of Motown soul, Nashville twang. They have cemented their signature sound and attracted some pretty impressive industry attention. They are the Middle Coast, and I spoke with them on the weekend about touring and about their new album and about opening for John and Roy. Here is our chat with the Middle Coast. I am here with Dylan and Liam from the Middle Coast. Hello, gentlemen.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. How do you do?
Welcome to Toronto.
I've never said that before in my life.
Yeah, don't do it again.
This must be warm for you guys, huh?
This is nice, man. This is actually our... We were going to go to Mexico, but we just thought Toronto, so... Doesn't really have the beach, but it's better.
You know, the people out here complain that it gets cold a lot, but I imagine Winnipeg is quite on the chilly side.
It's not awesome right now, but it's only going to get worse, so you know, we got that to look forward to.
A lot of snow?
Yes.
Is that where the name The Middle Coast comes from? Because you're pretty much smack dab in the middle of the country. Like, once you start heading east, there's nothing until Thunder Bay.
Exactly.
That's exactly it.
Yeah. Nailed it.
But yet there's no coastline, right? That's the joke, really.
Yeah.
People say coast to coast to coast, you know,
right,
there's the Hudson Bay up there.
Yeah.
Not that we really cared about that when we made the name, though.
There's some big lakes.
Yeah, there's some big lakes.
Now, you guys are originally from Brandon. In terms of being a young band in sort of a smaller town like Brandon, in terms of getting your name out there, how difficult was that to do in a place like that?
You know, we often talk about this. There's a lot of pros and cons. There's a lot of great gig opportunities when we were young, like things like rural fairs and, you know, things like that, that we probably wouldn't have had as many live playing opportunities in Winnipeg. But it obviously made sense to move to Winnipeg eventually, and we moved just over a year ago, and that was like, it was high time to get there.
Are you noticing a difference in just the type of opportunities that are available for you versus, you know, in Brandon versus Winnipeg?
I think that, when we lived in Brandon the last year or two prior to moving, we were driving in the Winnipeg, like, sometimes 2-3 times a month. So I think if anything, it's been just the ease of taking those opportunities but also, you know, people know you're in town, so we do a lot of kind of hired gun work as musicians too, and so we've got the opportunity to play with a lot of different artists and stuff, backing them up to supplement our income, and just it's a lot of fun. So yeah, it's been great.
Now I know you guys, you're working on a new album that's supposed to come out sometime next year.
It's out now, actually.
Oh, it is.
It is.
Hey, look, there's our third.
There's our third and final member.
So you guys have a new album out. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, we're really excited about it. It came out in spring, and we did some touring. We did a ton of summer festivals, and we're actually going on the road on November 29th to tour it again out west with a guy named Michael Bernard Fitzgerald. And so that'll be great.
The lead single off that was Paycheck.
Yes.
The origin of that track for you?
It's actually kind of like sort of what it's about.
Where did that song come from?
Yeah, it actually is. It comes from Brandon, actually. It's about a couple. It's about some drama that happened in some very public drama that happened in Brandon with a couple couples. And it's just kind of. I'll let Liam take the lead on that, I guess. But.
I think you pretty much get the idea. Yeah. We wrote it about that. It was fun. And I really like the song that came out of it. So
people in Brandon they haven't discovered podcasts yet, so we probably could go into more detail, but I have to be careful sometimes.
How do the personal lives of those around you influence your songwriting at all?
Just in general in Brandon?
Yeah.
I think it's kind of a fun thing to just write about different situations happening around you. I mean, I think it's something that Roman, I think, actually has said this, but songwriters are kind of self-absorbed sometimes. I was talking about themselves. So it can be kind of a fun exercise to just, like, tell other people's stories. Something that I certainly am still working at, but...
Yeah. I feel like really good songwriters can kind of connect to those other people's stories in a really deep way, too.
Totally.
So it's fun to try and do it.
Absolutely.
How would you describe your overall writing process as a band?
Well, it's kind of changing right now, in fact. We used to write a lot as a band, and we still like to do that, and we still make... I find that those songs come out in a really interesting way. But lately we've been writing separately and then bringing songs into the band, which has been really interesting because it kind of allows each individual person to totally flesh out their idea. And then after that, if there are changes to be made, you can make those changes, or sometimes it's better to just leave the song the way it is, based on how the person, whichever three of us wrote it, wanted it to be.
Yeah, the question comes at an interesting time because we're kind of, like, unsure. We're trying out sort of a lot of different ways because it's, you know, all three of us write, and that's a really great thing, and people often tell us how much of an asset that is, but it also is an interesting thing to navigate, too, so we're kind of... And it's been fun. We've just been kind of trying different ways, different formats.
How are you finding out what works for you as a band, what works for you creatively?
In the past, we've liked to live test stuff a lot.
That's true.
Like, because we used to... we still do. We play all the time, and we really love live playing, and we always found that to be a really fun way to see if a song works or not. But these days, I think we've been more on the side of just, like, taking a demo out, really fleshing it out, and then kind of seeing just which songs stand up against each other and which songs fit together, and I think that's been kind of an interesting way of doing it, too.
The one song that they sent me was Now and Then, off of the last album.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Where did that song come from for you guys?
Well, a lot of the songs off the record, actually, we last November, we were writing for the record, and we just decided to write every single day together. So we wrote like probably like 25 of the 30 days in that month or so. And so that was one of those, is we just got together and we went up into my attic at my house and just wrote every day. So yeah.
Given that you guys were writing in November and the album came out in April, that's a fairly quick turnaround for a band, for an album. Was that always going to be the case, or how did that process manifest itself for you?
It wasn't supposed to be the case. We made
it was a plan B.
Yeah, C, I think, actually.
Yeah, C.
We made a that lighting, love it. Just got romantic. We made a record, and then we kind of started making sort of our quote unquote first record when we were pretty young, like a couple years before this record came out. And we just kind of kept growing and getting better as we, you know, played more and wrote more together. And so we kind of made a record, kind of let it sit for a few months, felt like we had outgrown it, so we added a few songs, ended up scrapping almost the whole thing and doing this record, which, looking back on, it's kind of been an interesting process. But we've learned a ton in that time, and happy with this record now, and just looking forward to making more music.
Now, I know last year you guys won the Rising Star Award at the Winnipeg Folk Festival. What was that experience like for you guys? Having that, is there a certain amount of pressure once that honor has been bestowed upon you to live up to it?
Not really. It was nice though.
Yeah, we got a guitar.
Yeah,
it's cool.
It was a very nice thing to get, and I was honestly kind of surprised. There's a ton of talent in Winnipeg, so that was very nice. We have always loved the Folk Festival, and they have this great young performers program, which we'll all speak very highly about, and we've been doing since we were about 14 or 15 every year. And so, yeah, to get that award, that was a nice little pat on the back. But
and that was kind of our last year, too, because the year after, they were like, okay, you guys are done with this young performers thing. You've done it too many times.
Yeah.
And so I feel like that was a little bit of like, like, nice job, guys. You guys have come a long way since you were 15.
Yeah, exactly. That's fine.
That brings up the interesting point about, you know, because we always talk about, oh, like this new, young, up-and-coming band, right? But where does that transition happen for you between youth and experience, and sort of transitioning from the younger, you know, guys in a band want to be rock stars to actually, you know, legitimizing yourself and having others legitimize you within the community?
Yeah, totally. I think it's a sort of a natural progression, honestly. I mean, we've thought a lot about that because we played together for forever, and half of my answer, I think, to this question would be I'm not sure. But I think it sort of happens naturally, but anyone else can weigh in because I don't really know.
Certainly in the community of Winnipeg, there's just like, there's been people along pretty much every step of the way in our careers that have been encouraging us and recognizing us for what we've been doing. And so, like, if it's come from any community, it's from the local community, being recognized that way is really, really nice.
Where do you think Winnipeg, and to a greater extent, Manitoba, how would you describe their musical and cultural identity as it relates to Canada? I mean, you guys have Randy Bachman and Neil Young, but you know, where does Manitoba fit in?
That's a good question. Yeah, people go on about Winnipeg's great music scene all the time, and it is great. There's lots of different, you know, there's like tons of roots music that comes out of Winnipeg. There's like definitely a tradition of that. Lots of indie music and kind of hip music is coming out of there right now, which is really interesting. I mean, there's just lots of music in general coming out. As much as it's a super cliche, it is super cold in the winter, so that is kind of what people do. I think that actually is true, despite how much of a cliche that is, but... I don't know. I think that I know that a lot of bands say Winnipeg is, as a touring band, is a tough band or is a tough place to gain a following because people are picky there. And we're kind of learning about the scene both as people who live there and people who are new to there, and also from people who tour through, because I think it's very interesting. So, yeah.
Does being in that environment, you know, where it's so cold and there's always snow, does that does that bring about a certain type of creativity, a certain type of songwriter in terms of the content that is created?
Maybe. I think that, like, there's a reason. There's like a lot of roots music being made, and I think it's just like the same woes and the same kind of hardships and heartbreaks happen to prairie folk, and like kind of across the board. And it's like you all have this thing to relate to. These like this cold winter and this like long time without being able to go outside. And a lot of introspection.
That's definitely true.
I think more than anything, the thing that probably influences the Winnipeg and the Manitoba music scene is just like how connected it is, and because it, like,
so
it's
small.
Truly, it's a pretty small community. Like, I mean, Winnipeg has less than a million people, so people are always showing each other their music, and like you're always going to the different bands' shows, and you're
that's
always hearing
point.
What everyone's doing. So I think more than anything else, that's what kind of gives a band like a prairie sound, so to speak.
Now, I read on your Facebook page that you hope we brought the perfect beer. So, what is your favorite ale or lager or stout drink of choice?
I'm currently on a bit of a strong beer kick of these kind of like older, like they're kind of weird, but they're like 9%. And so you buy like a bottle and it's like $6. And they taste really kind of interesting. I don't really know much about them, but all I know is that you buy them for $6 and you kind of have a medium buzz on by the end of the night when you finish the whole thing. So I kind of like that. That's what I'm into.
I'm on this, it's an oatmeal stout by, mm-hmm. Who is it by? You always know.
Barnhammer.
yeah, Barnhammer is a local brewery in Winnipeg.
Yeah, I like Manitoba Standard.
It's classic beer.
Cheap, classic, easy. It's like me.
And the other thing that you guys are always on the lookout for is the perfect fast food burger.
Absolutely,
so
that's a heated discussion.
Where is the best burger that you've had?
You know, it's...
How long have you been this interview?
Yeah, exactly. You might want to pause and start again because this is a long conversation, but, I mean, it's undisputed. And if anyone does dispute, it's bullshit. But the Teen Burger is clearly the winner. But, I mean, you have to factor in price point, and Teen Burger doesn't really win as far as price point goes. I mean, if you have the coupes, then you're good, but I'm not sure. I don't know if you guys want to weigh in, but...
A&W has the best and pretty much the only fast food veggie burger that is available across Canada. So that's exciting for me. Although I find that, frankly, A&W, it's a little bland, so I usually like to put on some barbecue sauce that I get for myself.
Yeah, as a band, we got to stick together, you know? Like, it's good. Got a good veggie burger for Liam. So
yeah.
We all got to be in on this.
All the points are there.
fast food aside, best place to get a burger in Winnipeg.
New Burger would be my vote.
Yeah, I love New Burger.
New Burger's great. Boone Burger is vegan spot, actually, that's really wicked. And McDonald's. Yeah, those
it's a classic. There's other good ones too, but those come to mind.
Yeah.
And would you say you have a favorite track off of the Making of EP?
I don't know.
My favorite track is probably On the Clock. I really like how that one turned out.
Okay.
I don't know. Not probably not really.
Yeah, to be honest, I haven't listened to it in a long time.
I haven't listened to it since we made it, pretty much. Yeah.
You guys are one of those artists that listen to your own work?
I think that I personally listen to a lot when we're making it. Like, when we're making demos, I'll listen to them quite a bit. Because I'm excited about them and want to kind of reflect on them a lot. But once it's made, as much as it's really fun actually recording them, I personally, it's kind of like, sweet, done, stamp on it, and...
Yeah, there's so much excitement when you like are making like a demo and everything, because no one has heard it. You're just like, what can I change to make this better?
Yeah, totally.
And stuff. But
totally.
Then when it's out, it's just like, I'm never going to change this again. Don't care.
All right, well, the Middle Coast, thanks so much.
Thank you, man.
Thank you.
And that was my conversation with Liam, Dylan, and Roman, the three gents who make up the Middle Coast. That's all for the show this week. We're going to take you out with a final song by The Middle Coast off the album The Making Of. This Isn't Love. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next week. Bye for now.
You kiss me at a snail's pace. You make my lips taste. Try to stay in one place and just do one thing at a time. Oh, hold me closer, hold me closer now. Is this a dream come true?